Well, good morning, or good morning. I did this as an exhortation, just a trial of it running Richard, so it was good morning back then. Good evening, young people, brothers and sisters and friends. I'm glad when I got the program and got closer to writing the talk that the title of the talk came to paganism. Just make this a little darker for you. Paganism and where did it come from, or as I wrote it out, paganism versus Christianity. When I first got the title from the brother who put this together, it was paganism, where did it come from, and abortion. And I was thinking, whoa, not sure that one's going to go together. But you know, really, when you look at it, you will see that all of that is included in the talk that we'll have in front of us. We just passed through a time of the year when most people celebrate as Christadelphians try to avoid, and that is Christmas. We get together for a nice meal and maybe even exchange some gifts. However, we do not celebrate this day as the birth of the Lord Jesus Christ. In fact, the Bible is silent on the date of Christ's birth, probably for this very reason, as we just went through a season. We are to remember his life, his death, his resurrection together each week, not once a year. My intention is to bring to light facts. I don't want to pick upon any group of people, but I do want to point to a system. I also do not intend to judge anyone here this evening, but once again, bring facts so that we each can examine ourselves. So our goal for this talk is to find out what the problem is surrounding paganism and Christianity. And we want to check ourselves. We want to examine ourselves. This is the goal, to examine ourselves. So we're going to surround the topic of paganism. Where does it come from? How does it affect us today? Well, I think we should start by defining pagan or paganism. I thought I would ask this question. Have you ever thought of this word? Have you ever thought of the meaning of paganism to the young people? Really, we hear it. That's pagan. Well, that's just paganism. But really, what is it? Could we say that it means anything, really, that goes against Yahweh? The worship of any idol or any vain tradition? Well, let's just take a quick look where it came from. Pagan is derived from the Latin paganus, which was used at the end of the Roman Empire to name those who practiced a religion other than Christianity, Judaism, or Islam. Early Christians often used the term to refer to non-Christians who worshipped multiple deities. In Latin, paganus originally meant country dweller or civilian. It's believed that the world's religious meanings developed either from the enduring non-Christian religious practices of those who lived far from the Roman cities where Christianity was more quickly adopted, or from the fact that early Christians referred to themselves as soldiers of Christ, making non-believers civilians. Okay, there's our history lesson for a little while. So we brought back to the day that just passed, December 25th. You wonder, why am I going back to December 25th? Why am I dealing with Christmas? Why are we dealing with this in this talk for paganism and Christianity? Of course, all the Christians just worshipped December 25th, the birth of Christ. So what would that have to do with this? Well, there's a bit of an issue, and I think what it will do is it will formulate our whole talk. It's an issue that has infiltrated the most of society and most holidays as we know them. The intermixing of paganism and Christianity is astounding. This topic that Mike gave me to talk about, I thought, where am I going to go with paganism and where did it come from? But there were so many threads and so many roads to go down, it almost became overwhelming where one could possibly have done the whole weekend on just this alone. Even though the churches would like to believe that they remain separate from pagan beliefs, we will in fact find that they are steeped in the practices and traditions that have been handed down from long before Jesus. In fact, that's really where we want to start this talk. Way, way back to where it all began. To where it is believed that these beliefs and traditions began. I understand that you had an exhortation last week. I'm not sure who gave it on the traditions of Christmas. John? No? Justin? I'll probably repeat many things that you probably said, so because there's no getting around it, no getting away from it. So to find our beginnings to the day which is now celebrated as Christmas, or the birth of Jesus, we have to begin at a time period shortly following the flood, spoken of in Genesis. There was a man who was the son of Ham. The sons of Ham, Cush, Mizraim, Put, and Canaan. The sons of Cush, Seba and Havilah, Sabta, Raama, Sabtika, and the sons of Raama, Sheba, and Dedan. And Cush begat Nimrod. He began to be mighty one in the earth. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Wherefore it is said, even as Nimrod, the mighty hunter before the Lord. And the beginning of his kingdom was Babel, and Erech, and Akkad, and Calna, in the land of Shinar. Now I always thought of Nimrod building Babel. But when we look at it, he actually had a kingdom. It wasn't just a building he built. He had a kingdom, and it took in many places. And here, young people and brethren and sisters, is the beginning of the downfall, where pagan beliefs began. And later, they were so evenly blended into Christianity that one cannot really find the line in the sand anymore. We hope to show this today so that we can be warned to examine ourselves, to see if there is a fence around the truth, keeping these pagan ideas and traditions from entering our homes and our ecclesias. It says here that Nimrod was a mighty hunter. Now, when I read this, I think, what does he hunt? What was around the area? What kind of animals? He was a king. He was busy building an empire. When did he have time to go hunting? Well, I would propose that he was not indeed just a hunter of animals, but he was a hunter of men. He needed mankind to buy into his ideas so that he could become a mighty man in all the earth. Look what Mighty Hunter says, a hunter of men, a persecutor of God's people. Interesting, isn't it? And when we look at Micah chapter 7, verse 2, it says, did it come up? There it is. The good man is perished out of the earth, and there is none upright among men. They all lie in wait for blood. They hunt every man his brother with a net. We have in the expositor that he became a hero of the chase, not only of animals, but also of men. He ruthlessly hunted all those who opposed his will, as Rome has done in the succeeding ages. And it's significant that inscriptions, as we will see in a short time here, portray the ancient monarchs as skillful hunters, indicating their ability in the chase was reflected in their rule, in their governmental rule. And as mighty hunters, these Gentile rulers stand in complete contrast to the rulers of Israel, who were set forth as shepherds of the kingdom. So it says he was a mighty hunter before Yahweh, that is, in his sight, in defiance of his will, as before the flood. Thus, the characteristic of rebellion against God, which was introduced in Eden by the action of the serpent and manifested willful opposition by mankind since, is seen to be a feature of the flesh. In this, Nimrod illustrated the meaning of his name, "We will rebel." It's interesting, as we just commented in the readings, that when one rebels, you have to rebel against something that you know. He knew what was right and what was wrong. The exploits and the rule of Nimrod became the basis of comparison by which all successive rulers were compared, and to the ideal to which they aspired. So, why do we look at Nimrod for our answer to this Christmas holiday season, which is being celebrated? Well, the story goes that when Nimrod died, When Nimrod died, his wife became pregnant through one of the beams of the sun with another illegitimate son, whom she said was actually the reincarnation of Nimrod himself. Still asking the question, what does that have to do with Christmas? Nimrod had been self-declared God of the sun. And during the winter solstice, when the sun began to reappear about this time, it was believed that the sun was being reborn. It was a week called Saturnalia. And during that week, Semiramis, Nimrod's wife and mother, gave birth to her son, Tammuz, on the 25th of December, thereby declaring that Nimrod was reincarnated as the birth of the sun. The story is that, as I mentioned, one of the beams from the god of this sun, Nimrod, entered her. She became impregnated, gave birth then to the savior of the world, Tammuz. That was Tammuz, was the sun. And then you can see in this depiction over here, Semiramis holding up Tammuz and the beams of the sun. So it's showing these are all related. The reason I put these up here is to show some of the artifacts that they found of Semiramis. You can see with the bullhorns and the sun in the bullhorns. And as time went on, we see a depiction of the Virgin Mary, supposed as the churches have, with Jesus on her knee, very similar to the Semiramis and Tammuz picture. There were many things that happened around this time period, for it says that Semiramis declared that when she gave birth to Tammuz, the sun, an old, withered-up pine tree resprang to life, thus indicating the resurrection and rebirth and renewal of Nimrod, who was known as the sun god. From this came the worship of the pine tree, which in that time was decorated with candles and the heads of those who opposed the traditions of child sacrifice. Similar as we see the decorations hanging upon trees today. Interesting it is that this pine tree, or this pine tree, continues to be worshipped by the church in many ways. For example, if we look at this picture, this is a pine cone sitting in the Vatican. If you look at their, well, you can't really see it from here, but on their staff is a pine cone on the Pope's staff, again here. Later on in the Bible, we see familiar names which are tied to Nimrod, which took the liberty of declaring himself to be this god, and called by other names such as Baal or Bel or Moloch, among other names. As we can see on this form, I won't read them all. But if you look at here, other names for Nimrod, which we'll come across any time that we're reading the Bible, you might find Moloch, Baal, Bel. He's also called Saint Valentine, Dagon. And these were other gods worshipped by other places. For example, Dagon was the Philistines, but it was just another name for Nimrod, Shamash, and all of these, Saturn, Jupiter. Well, Semiramis was no different, the mother. She was also declared a god herself and worshipped as the mother of the Savior, for she brought forth the reincarnated sun god, and her name became the Queen of Heaven, known as well as Ashtoreth, or Astarte, where we get the word Easter from, among other names. As you can see, we have Semiramis and Tammuz, Baal. In Israel, they were told not to worship Ashtoreth or Baal. It's the same as this. In Greek, it was Aphrodite. In Egypt, it was Isis as the goddess mother and Horus as the child. In India, Devaki was the goddess, Krishna was the child. They're all related to Semiramis and Tammuz. It didn't go away. So if Nimrod was given the name Baal, then we must investigate, what is the history of Baal? Was there a name change to this god as people developed and grew? Because we certainly don't hear of Baal today. So we must examine and trace the life trail of this god, Baal. Perhaps due to the confusion of the languages and the scattering of the people to worship the sun, the worship of the sun god remained. We remember in Babel, God confused the languages, people scattered. and the sun god remained. It was just under the guise of other names, along with Semiramis, his wife, and the many changes that happened in her name as well. It must be noted here that even though there was a name change, the religious practice did not change. Baal worship later transferred to another god known as Osiris. The name signifies mighty one, and so it was among the Egyptian gods. This was a transfer then from the great god Baal to the great god Osiris, who had ties from Babylon. Later, the movement took them to Odin. Odin is another very important god, but now just Baal migrated to the Norsemen, again due to the scattering of the people, due to the rebellion at the Tower of Babel. You know, it's interesting when we look at this god Odin, Odin. He is depicted as a one-eyed, long-bearded, frequently wielding a spear, wearing a cloak and a broad hat. And he's often accompanied by animal companions who bring him information from all over Midgard. And he rides a flying eight-legged steed called Sleipnir across the sky and into the underworld. Well, isn't it interesting? It is said that when Tammuz died, he went to the underworld. Thus, we have Nimrod as the power of the highest, and Tammuz as the power of the underworld, or as people test, hell. Next we have Nicholas. And you know where we're going with this now, don't you? He's known to the Greeks as the god of the sea. And although there was a real man's name, Nicholas, who was in the clergy, he was first depicted as a god. In fact, even the real Nicholas, who happened to be one of the signatories on the Nicene Creed, was depicted as a very good man. He had a reputation for secret gift-giving, such as putting coins in the shoes of those who left them out for him. And that was a practice that was celebrated on his feast day. Next, we have Sinterklaas. He's a historical figure with legendary and folklore origins who's based on St. Nicholas. He's an elderly, stately, serious man with white hair, a long, full beard. He wears a long red cape over a traditional white bishop's alb, and sometimes red full garment. He dons a red mitre and ruby red ring. So a red mitre is a hat and a ruby red ring. He holds a gold-colored staff, a long shepherd's staff with a fancy curled top. He traditionally rides a white horse. In the Netherlands, the horse is called Amerigo, and in Belgium, it has the meaning of bad weather. Well, Sinterklaas carries a big red book called the Book of Sinterklaas, in which is written whether a child has been good or naughty in the past year. I would wonder why, if Baal has the same name as Moloch, and Moloch was a god where they offered children, why would they need a book that contains the names of naughty and nice children? Well, next we come to Santa Claus. He became known today as Santa Claus, and he's known for that throughout the whole world. Well, we can see if we look at this chart, a progression. Oh, nearly 5,000 years. Nimrod, the god of the sun, wearing red as a symbol of the sun. And this was proven from history. He always wore red because he was the god of the sun. In statues that are depicted of him, we see it up here of him depicted as a man with a long beard. Does this sound familiar? The birth of Tammuz, the sudden appearance of a pine tree out of nowhere, worship of the sun and Saturn, which carries many other properties associated with Christmas, such as the lights that are placed on a house or on the tree, the ornaments that are placed on the tree, or we even look to the top of the tree, in which times past and even present is always a star. Paganism and Christianity. Where is the line in the sand? Well, the church today says they separate themselves from anything pagan. Yet, if we were to just to look at a few of the traditions that come from Nimrod, we would see that their doctrines and traditions are carried forward. And it simply alarms you that when we look back to Nimrod, we see Christmas and Easter, the Trinity, the nameless Lord worship, as remember Paul went in and they said this was to the unknown God, the cross used in worship, which we'll cover in just a moment, hellfire doctrine, and so on and so forth, the soul of immortality. It all came from Nimrod. Our holidays as well stem from some form of pagan rites or worship. So I want to just look at a few of the pagan traditions that have been passed down from the time of Nimrod to the churches today who say they are absolutely separate from paganism. This will astound you. So I have about 6 slides that I just want to run over with you. When we look at the first one, it's called the Zucchetti, which is this part here, the hat. It's worn by the priests, cardinals, and the pope. And it represents respect, fear, and submission to Cybele, the mother goddess of Rome. Just bringing back anything to do with Semiramis. The cap of Cybele is one of the oldest and most sacred pagan religious symbols of humanity, dating back to 2000 BC. The skull cap was worn by the sun priests of Egypt, the skull cap. And you notice on the skull cap how it has a 6-sided hexagon. We talked about Saturnalia, the worship of Saturn. So if we were to look at the north pole of Saturn, we would see this, the hexagon. Isn't it interesting how that fits into this? And then we see that fitting onto this. It's a thin, slightly rounded skull cap, now commonly known by various titles, including the, I won't pronounce it properly, I know there's some in here that speak a little Hebrew, Yarmulke, and the Kufi. The Roman Catholic Church calls this the Zucchetti. Vatican Hill was the site of the largest ancient temple to Cybele, Ashtoreth, the goddess of fertility, sexuality, and war, and was known as Cybele in Rome. And you know, when we look at the Bible, it says, then the children of Israel again did evil in the sight of the Lord and served Baals and Ashtoreth. This cap came from the goddess of Cybele in Rome. Look at the next one. The mitre hat that's worn by the priests, cardinals, and the pope represents Dagon, the Babylonian fish god. The ancient Babylonians worshipped Dagon, the god of agriculture, plenty of food, and good fortune. The Babylonian priests wore a headdress that represented the worship of Cybele and Dagon. It featured an open fish mouth hat with the rest of the fish body forming the cloak. We have Cybele, Semiramis, and we have Dagon, Tammuz. So here we have in the Roman Empire, it was worn by the head of the priest of Cybele, the great queen or mother goddess, Semiramis. Today, the cardinals, bishops, and the popes all wear the open fish mouth mitre, which represents the worship of Cybele and Dagon. Notice the similarities between the two hats. Notice how it fits on top of Cybele. So you have Dagon and you have Cybele. The mitre hat of Dagon is always worn over the kippah of Ashtoreth or Cybele, as you can see in the picture of Pope Francis. Next slide. The obelisk in St. Peter's Square represented the worship of the sun god. Obelisks were prominent in architecture of the ancient Egyptians, who placed them at the entrance of a temple, making it a zone of sun worship. Goes right back to the Nimrod, the god of the sun. They represent the sun god Ra, the Egyptians' greatest deity, the creator of humanity, the source of all heat and light, the being on which man is totally dependent. The most well-known Egyptian obelisk was re-erected in 1586 in front of St. Peter's Basilica. It's surrounded by a sun wheel, right here. I don't know if you can see it in the picture. With the points lining up with the vernal equinox, the summer solstice, and the winter solstice. So if you could see the lines in this square, you would see where they line up. And in the center is the obelisk. During the sunrise on the vernal equinox, the sun causes the obelisk to cast its shadow onto the dome of St. Peter's Basilica, which represents the sexual union of the sun god and the moon goddess. Well, we just covered that with Semiramis being impregnated by this one of the beams of the sun. Here it is today. Another Egyptian obelisk sits in front of the Pantheon of ancient Rome, which housed statues of their pagan gods. The obelisk was originally constructed by Pharaoh Ramses for the temple of Ra, sun, in Hierapolis. It was brought to Rome in ancient times, where it is used near a shrine to the Egyptian god Isis. The Pantheon was dedicated to Pan Theos, meaning all the gods. When it became a Roman Catholic church, it was dedicated to the Virgin Mary and all the martyrs. Here it is here. The six-sided star is the supreme symbol of satanic tyranny. I don't know how many people know this. Probably most of you do. The hexagram, which if you notice in the center, is the six-sided hexagram. We got that off the north pole of Saturn as well. Is used by people such as pagan Babylonians, Egyptian, Assyrians to directly or indirectly worship Satan. Helena Blavatsky wrote that Lucifer is the true God, and she incorporated the hexagram in the emblem of the Theosophical Society, which you can look up anywhere you want to find it. Satanists, Luciferians, astrologers, and witches use it to invoke the power of demons. The six-sided star numerically equals 666 because you have six little points. You have six triangles, small triangles, and you have a six-sided hexagon. Interesting that it adds up to 666. Some Christians pass this off as the Star of David, but really the truth is David never did have a star, if you look in the scriptures. In fact, it was told that King Solomon used it in witchcraft, magic, and idolatrous worship to Ashtoreth, Semiramis, and to Moloch, Nimrod, or Tammuz. Stephen says, "You took up the tent of Moloch and the star of your god Remphan." If you look up the word Remphan in Strong's, you'll see it is Saturn. "The figures which you made," "in order to worship them." The Maltese cross, I don't know if you can see it very good there, represents Shamash. Well, it was one of the names of Nimrod, the god of the sun and justice. In the image, an ancient Assyrian king is wearing the cross on his chest, just like the one seen on the chest of the robe of the Pope. Shamash, or Akkadian Samas, sun, was a native Mesopotamian deity, sun god, in the Akkadian, Assyrian, and Babylonian pantheons. It was the god of justice in Babylonia. The cross was identified with a sun god 8 centuries before Christ and long before it was called the Maltese cross by the Knights of Malta. It's also called the Iron Cross, and Roman Catholic Adolf Hitler renewed use of the Iron Cross in 1939 and superimposed the Nazi swastika in its center. If you look at the swastika, it's actually just a bent cross. We'll get to that. The pine cone, as we talked, symbolized the worship of the solar god Osiris, another name for Nimrod. Pine cones are associated with spiritual enlightenment by ancient Babylonians, Egyptians, and Greeks. They represent the mysterious link between the physical and the spiritual worlds, which can be found in the human brain in the pineal gland. The pine cone staff was a symbol of the solar god Osiris, originated in Egypt, where he was their Messiah who died for his people and whose mother, Isis, was worshipped as the Virgin Mother. Well, the Vatican also has the world's largest pine cone that once decorated a fountain. I showed you a picture of that in ancient Rome next to a vast temple of Isis. You might have another picture of it right here for you. So that pine cone sits in the Vatican. The old St. Peter's Basilica was dedicated to Attis, son and lover of Sybil. The Catholic Church then relocated to its what's now called the Vatican Court of the Pigna. That's where it is now. So the pine cone, remember the pine tree, and things that are related to that. So I just wanted to look at a few traditions that are that were passed down there and ask the question, have the rays of the sun... I'm talking about the sun, the white, the big bright sun, fried some cells. I wonder, you can be the judge. Here's the rays of the sun god. These are all old, depicted from the past. And it's really interesting when you look at them. Because beside it, we see a present picture of the Pope. What is he holding? He's got to be as close to the sun as I can see. Or, what about this? I put it right beside this. Whoa. Similarities. The scriptures speak of worshiping the tree long before Santa Claus, long before Christmas was even thought of. If you were to look at Jeremiah, you would see this. It says, "Thus saith the Lord, learn not the way of the heathen, and be not dismayed at the signs of heaven, for the heathen are dismayed at them. For the customs of the people are vain, for one cutteth a tree out of the forest, the work of the hands of the workmen with the axe." Well, what do they do with it next? They deck it with silver and gold, and they fasten it with nails and with hammers, that it move not. Semiramis and her followers allegedly claim that on December 25th, an evergreen tree grew up overnight from a dead stump in Babylon. Nimrod would secretly return at the same time each year to leave gifts on the tree. This was the real beginning of what is celebrated now as Christmas. Santa Claus was only Nimrod. The star came to be worshipped at about the same time, and actually it was Saturn. But the symbol they worshipped for Saturn was the star. The scriptures are very clear that it was not to be worshipped. Many have attributed the star to David, but however, it is not found in scripture. As we mentioned in Stephen's defense, he mentions the worship of the star of Remphan, or Strong says, Saturn. If we were to look in Amos, we would see the punishment brought upon the nation as a result of continuing in the practice of worshiping Moloch and other gods, including the star of Kayun, another name for Saturn. The six-sided star is used and has been used for centuries as a satanic form of casting a hex. It is called a hexagram because of the six-sided hex inside the star. Thus, six sides, six triangles, and six points lead us to 666, or that which goes against the teachings of Christ, where we began. What is paganism? Have ye offered unto me sacrifices and offerings in the wilderness 40 years, O house of Israel? But ye have borne the tabernacle of your Moloch and Kayun, your images, the star of your God, which ye have made to yourselves. Therefore I will cause you to go into captivity beyond Damascus, saith the Lord, whose name is the Lord, the God of hosts. Well, we beat up Christmas pretty good. So we look at another time we won't spend much on, as observed by the worldwide religious festivals, and that is the birth of Semiramis, or Ishtar. She falsely claimed to have lived as a spirit before the flood, and they have come down from heaven in a huge egg and dropped into the Euphrates River. The goddess of the Ishtar egg, the Easter egg, was none other than Semiramis under another name. Has this affected society today? Has this Nimrod, Semiramis, and Tammuz affected church doctrines? Out of their false religion and worship of idols and traditions they have practiced came all the doctrines that churches teach today. Even the cross had its origin in the time of Semiramis and Tammuz. That which is now called the Christian cross was originally no Christian emblem at all, but it was the mystic Tau, T-A-U, of the Chaldeans and Egyptians, the true original form of the letter T, the initial of the name of Tammuz. That mystic Tau was marked in baptism on the foreheads of those initiated in the mysteries and was used in every variety of way as a most sacred symbol. The Vestal Virgins of pagan Rome wore it suspended from their necklaces as the nuns do now. The Egyptians did exactly the same thing. There is hardly a pagan tribe where the cross has not been found. The cross was worshipped by the pagan Celts long before the incarnation and death of Christ. The ancient Egyptian hieroglyphic symbol of life, the Anak, a Tau cross surmounted by a loop and known as the Kru Ansanta, was adopted and extensively used on Coptic Christian monuments. You see it often. It's this top one here. But any form of these were found, and as I mentioned, the swastika as a bent cross. Tammuz was the god of the underworld, as we mentioned earlier. I found this late as I was doing this talk, but I thought it had such a great impact about talking about Semiramis, Nimrod, and Tammuz. If we were to look at newly renovated art where the Pope sits, we would be just shocked. He sits in front of this while they do various activities. Do we see in this anything that relates to what is called the resurrection? And that's what the title of this art is. Oh, it's supposed to be Jesus Christ. But if we were to look really close, you be the judge. More importantly, has this paganism affected us? All the holidays that are celebrated by the world have been derived by some form or another of pagan origins. Is the worship of Nimrod still a factor today? Well, you bet it is. Listen to this article that was put forward by the New York Times magazine just last year. This was the title: The Temple of Baal Will Be Erected in Times Square in New York City. Can you imagine? The Temple of Baal. This is copied and pasted. The Temple of Baal, also known as the Temple of Bel, was a world-famous landmark that was located in Palmyra, Syria. In August 2015, this temple was destroyed by ISIS, and most of the world recoiled in terror, get this, at the loss of a cultural heritage site. Well, in an attempt to preserve history, two exact replicas of the 50-foot arch that stood at the entrance to the temple will be erected in April 2016 in Times Square in New York City and in Trafalgar Square in London. It goes on to say there are a lot of people quite disturbed about this. In ancient times, child sacrifice, bisexual orgies were common practices at the altar of Baal. And now we're putting up a monument to worship to this false god in the heart of the most important city. Well, the Christians did put their foot down and said, no way. The project has been put on hold. However, how long will it be before the minority cry out injustice? Freedom of worship. It says in the Bible, it will be as in the days of Noah. Constantine, a pagan, tried to keep church and pagan worship separate. But in an effort to please all mankind, he blended the worship of both together. So where is the line in the sand? Well, humanism is a direct result of this practice, young people and brothers and sisters. I get what I want whenever I want. It's all about me, and it's never my fault. The great question is before us, can I see the difference? Can you see the difference? Can we see the difference? Can we live the difference? Can we draw a line in the sand? The modern world is steeped in pagan worship. It is all around us. If we look at this innocent Santa Claus, he's only holding a tree and a reindeer in a bag. Uh-oh, Nimrod holding a tree with a reindeer under his arms. We see any difference? We can be caught up unawares. I kind of want to just finish with a little story. So when I was young, just kind of goes to not judging anyone. When I was young and growing up, we grew up mostly in isolation away from ecclesias. But we had a Christmas tree, a silver one. I remember it very well. We had presents under the tree and lots of them, nice ones. Looked forward to that. We had the stockings on the door of our bedrooms when we woke up in the morning. We could sit on our bed and open the little tiny presents till we got to the big ones when everybody was awake. We decorated the Christmas tree and we put a star on the top. I look at this talk and I think, what? What was my dad thinking? Most of you, if you know my dad, you'd think, what? Joe? were we blended? Paganism and Christadelphianism? If I was standing here now, I would say absolutely. There's no question. So yes, it does blend. Some things never change. Let us focus on the true Son of Righteousness when we are thinking of our daily Bible readings. We must remember his life, death, and resurrection each week, every day, not one day, each week, each day, until he comes. Let us, to the best of our abilities, be aware of the dangers that lurk close to us, to keep a line in the sand, a fence around the truth, so that we may not be swept away with the tide of paganism. Let us encourage one another. Very important. We need encouragement from each other to fight the good fight, to maintain the road in which we each run, to keep unspotted from the idols and the evil practices of the world around us. We just sang in our hymn, "Search us, O God, and know each heart. With every idol bid us part. Help us to keep thy holy ways and live to utter forth thy praise."